It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat This State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, well, we got a lot to cover, so we're going to dive right in. Last week we started the election recommendations.
Yeah, and we're going to go through these pretty quickly this morning because we got a lot of other stuff to cover as well. But this is all up at www.eatthestate.org. Last week we covered the initiatives and ballot measures. So this week we'll talk about elected offices. Starting off with mayor, and this really isn't much of a race. Greg Nichols has raised over $500,000. His challenger, Al Runty, has raised about $8,000. And Runty may still get up to 40% of the vote, which raises the question of how well a progressive challenger to Nichols might actually have done had one been able to be recruited to run in this race. Unfortunately, Nichols' $500,000 war chest scared people off, and so we have essentially a coronation for mayor. But I'm voting for Runty. He's a progressive. He's a good guy. He's somewhat inexperienced, of course, but he's not going to win. This is in the form more of a protest vote against the very pro-development agenda of Greg Nichols and passing along the message that not everybody in Seattle agrees with ignoring the neighborhoods and giving Paul Allen the keys to the city. One other possible strategy on this is to not vote at all in the mayor's race. The number of votes tabulated in the mayor's race is the figure that's used, a percentage of the figure is used to determine how many signatures are needed for ballot initiatives. So for the next couple of years, if you don't vote in the mayor's race, it makes it easier to get ballot measures on the ballot. So that's another possibility as well. But I'm endorsing Runty in that race. And Maria's nodding her head.
Yeah, I don't want to have to say yes to all of these, but yeah.
Okay. Next, we have city attorney Tom Carr is running unopposed. On general principle, I don't vote in unopposed races. This is not the Soviet Union, at least not yet. City council races. Position number two, we have Richard Conlin running for re-election against Paige Miller. Conlin can be maddeningly inconsistent as a progressive. He's very much a guy who looks down his nose at the underprivileged, very patronizing in that kind of sense. However, he's also one of the only city councilmen who's stood up to Greg Nichols and his agenda and asked some hard questions, and he listens to his constituents, which I will give him credit for. He's somebody who can do some good on the city council. His opponent, Paige Miller, is not. She's been on the Port of Seattle Commission as a commissioner for a couple of terms, demonstrated herself to be very much in the pocket of big business. She's reiterated those themes in her run for city council. That's where she's gotten a lot of her money, and she would be a disaster on city council. So Richard Conlin in the race for position number two. Position number four, we have Casey Kaur, the former mouthpiece for Greg Nichols, and before that a columnist for the Times and PI, is taking on Jan Drago. Kaur is something of a cipher. He's liberal on some issues, conservative on others, very much of his own person, even though he worked for Nichols for 4 years. On the other hand, Drago is a disaster. Former head of the Seattle Downtown Business Association. Not only is she in the pocket of big business, but she's also clueless on a lot of issues. She has not been good on city council at all, and for that reason, even though I have some questions about him, I'm willing to take a chance on Casey Kaur, because we know what we've got in Jan Drago, and it's never going to be good. So we might as well take a chance on somebody who could be good. So Casey Kaur for position number four. And then position number six is the very vexing kind of race between Richard McIver and Dwight Pels. Now, both these guys have something to recommend them. Pels has been a solidly liberal voice on county council for a number of years. McIver has been the only African-American on city council for the last 8 years, but he's also been a remarkably inert presence on city council. He has done very little outside of his assigned committee responsibilities, really has not provided leadership on anything that you could point to. And, you know, it would be nice to have somebody on city council who actually earns their living. On the other hand, Dwight Pelz, not only has he not run a very aggressive campaign, he's kind of mailed it in, but he's very much in favor of South Lake Union development. He's a close, long-term buddy of Greg Nickels, and he has some other problems also. So in this race, I'm not recommending either one of them. I'm inclined to just skip this one because I don't think either one of them deserved the seat. But one of them will win, so we'll see what we get.
As far as I'm concerned, I looked at this race very closely because, like Job, I don't really like either one of them. I thought Dwight Pelz would be good, but I'm shocked at how little he knows about Seattle City issues.
Yeah.
And the issues he does know something on, as Job said, are things like developer issues and Greg Nickels' agenda, which is alarming. So looking at this race, I thought, okay, now what it comes down to is who listens to their constituents and who might be persuaded to advocate for people who have a problem and they bring it to City Hall. And as far as I can tell, in the last 8 years, Richard McIver's attitude is to duck and hide whenever people come to him with a problem. And he waits for things to just kind of go away. He doesn't really do a whole lot on them. And that in itself, I think, is more destructive than having somebody on the council who's pro-Mayor Nickels, because at least the pro-Mayor Nickels guy, you can protest against him, you can send him mail, you can,
he's there.
You can get him replaced the next election. But if you've got somebody who just sits there and does nothing, getting him off the council can be really hard. Pelz, at least, shows that he can listen to people and understand what they're saying and talk a little bit about how people feel, because the one thing he's played up during his campaign is that he's talked to a lot of residents in Seattle. So I'm much more willing to vote for Pelz now than I was at first, even though I know he might not be the best presence on the council, because at least he's going to listen to people, whereas McIver's attitude is always, oh, my God, go away. I don't want to have to deal with this.
That's fair enough. And then we have the one last city council race, which is for position number 6. I think I said 6 before for Pelz McIver, but that's number 8. This is Nick Licata running for re-election, running against a guy, Nick, can you remember his name? Paul Bascom, I believe it is.
Mm-hmm.
Bascom is a free market Republican who's not going to get 10% of the vote. Nick Licata is the best city council person we've had in a generation. We have to get him back on city council. He's just wonderful. And he has demonstrated time and again his ability to keep progressive values while still working with people that he disagrees with and winning them over. 2 years ago, the Seattle Police Officers Guild was mortified when Licata took over the Public Safety Committee, which has oversight of SPD. Now the Police Officers Guild is endorsing Nickels for re-election. So
Licata,
sorry. So that tells you something about how Licata works. He's just a jewel. Nick Licata for re-election.
Yeah, I don't agree with everything Nick Licata does, but he is far better than most of the other city council members. And Bascom is just purely, the free market will solve everything, and that's simply theory and doesn't bear out in the real world. So,
yeah. Moving along to the school district, we have first we have incumbent Murray Bass, the only incumbent running for re-election this time, is facing a very well-funded challenge from Jane Fellner. Fellner has done a lot of good things as a community activist over the years, but she's being backed by a lot of the old boy network that wants to see reform candidates off of city council. They have a majority after the election of 2 years ago, and the only one they can go after in this election is Mary Bass. She was on the council, on the school board, rather, before any of the other progressives. She was calling BS on Joseph Olszewski's bad numbers. She's a financial analyst in her day job, and she's done a wonderful job on school board, representing constituents from her central area district. She's African American. She's made a priority out of emphasizing disproportionality and other race related issues. And she has earned a second term. She's been very good. So Mary Bass in that race. We have Astrid Dare Jolin, I think is how it's pronounced, who is very bright, very personable. Unfortunately, she's 19 years old, and At this point, I think the school district has so many problems that it needs people on the school board that have some adult experience. We really, you know, I love the idea of having student or recent student representation on the school board, but now is not the time for that kind of experiment. Michael DeBell is the person running against her, and he's fairly solid. So Michael DeBell in that race. And then we have Cheryl Chow trying to get back into elected office once again. She was a disaster on Seattle City Council. Absolutely, utterly clueless, arrogant, a downtown special interest kind of vote. But more than anything else, she's just not very bright in the experience of a lot of people who've worked with her. She is, and she hasn't done very well in a lot of her education positions either. She's running against Linda Thompson Black. I think Thompson Black is a far better candidate, and will do well on the school board. So Linda Thompson Black rather than Cheryl Chow.
Yeah. Thompson Black has some, experience working with budgets, and that's something that's very needed on the city council, on the Seattle School Board right now. And Cheryl Chow doesn't have that experience. She's been a principal of a school, which means she's very much in the school district sort of hierarchy, and I think people ought to pass that up.
Yeah. We're probably going to disagree over the monorail board. There are two races, both of which pit incumbents who want to see the monorail project continue against challengers who do not. I would prefer the challengers who don't. Even if it were not a question of continuing the project, I think the board has been so inept over the last 3 years that even for the incumbents who have been relatively good on the board, as both of these have been, it's sort of like saying the River Styx is the most navigable body of water in hell. It's still a board that has just been almost criminally negligent in allowing this project to go off the rails. And in the case of the first race with Cindy Laws, I still can't forgive her anti-Semitic comments. I think those disqualify her from public office. She's running against Beth Goldberg. I'm voting for Goldberg in that race. We went through this in the primary. I know you're voting for Laws and Stockmeyer,
but she wasn't here in the primary, so.
I didn't give my opinion in the primary. We talked about it, though.
That's right.
I wrote an article for the paper, but yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I mentioned though that we had a disagreement.
I see it as either you're for killing the monorail or you're for keeping it going. And if you're for keeping it going, you go Cindy Laws and Cleve Stockmeyer.
Yeah.
If you're on the other side, though, you go for jobs candidates,
which are Beth Goldberg and Jim Nobles. And we talked about continuing the monorail last week, so I don't really want to get into that again. Let's see. We have the King County executive race, which pits Ron Sims against David Irons. Now, David Irons would be a disaster on county as a King County executive, and this will be a relatively close race. So, if you believe in the lesser of two evils, all the way down the line, you can vote for Ron Sims. I'm not that enamored with Ron Sims. He's been county executive for two terms. He's been far less liberal in his administration of King County than he's been when he's run for higher office, done a lot of budget cuts of social services, for example. And fortunately, there's a third candidate in this race, Gentry Lang, who's the Green Party candidate. The Green Party in Seattle and King County is in something of a state of disarray right now, so Lang's candidacy has not gotten very much publicity. But he's very bright, he's very articulate, and he would be good. And I think third-party candidacies should be supported when they have good people running. So I'm going to vote for Gentry Lang rather than any of the other two.
And I agree with that, too. I just cannot bring myself to vote for Ron Sims. He's a Democrat of the worst kind, the kind that follows in Gary Locke's footsteps, I call myself a Democrat, but I really want to be a Republican. David Irons, on the other hand, goes far to the right, so your choice there is not a great one. And considering that Ron Sims' name has such name recognition, I doubt David Irons is going to win in this race, and I'm going for Gentry Lang.
Yeah, the polls are very close, but I think Sims probably will win. The other thing about Irons is he took Ryan Drudowski off of county council. He ran in a Republican primary against him 8 years ago, and Drudowski was a suburban environmentalist who put together coalitions that we simply haven't seen before or since in county politics.
The kind of old-style Republican that brings fond fond memories to people who used to be Republican and are now Democrat.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's what everything Irons, who is very, very much in the pocket of suburban developers, everything he does not represent. So whatever you do, don't vote for Irons. We have the King County Sheriff's race. This pits Sue Rahr, who is the appointed incumbent, against Jim Schmidt. Rahr has had problems with scandals, both as on her own watch and as number two under Dave Reichert before he was elected to Congress. Meanwhile, you have Jim Schmidt, who has a reputation as something of a bully and has a domestic violence rap in his past, everything that you do not want in a top law enforcement cop. I'm going to skip this one. I'm not sold that that Rahr runs a clean ship, but you know, I would sooner vote for her than vote for Jim Schmidt.
Yeah, me too.
We have the King County Council. There are several suburban races pitting Democrats who probably don't have much of a chance of winning against Republicans who do. And there are several races in the city of Seattle pitting Democrats who have every chance in the world of winning against Republicans who don't. There simply aren't many competitive races in the county council races. Of the in-city races, Larry Gossett very much deserves re-election. The rest of them, I'm saying skip it because they're, you know, people like Dow Constantine and Larry Phillips, who basically occupy warm seats on the body. They're Seattle liberal Democrats of the worst kind who never actually do very much or take very many risks or, God forbid, listen to constituents. So I'm simply not very, very, very enamored of them. And Maria is nodding her head. let's see, and we also have a Court of Appeals judge race in which somebody is running unopposed, so I'm going to skip that. And finally, we have the Port of Seattle commissioner races, and then there are several of them. Lawrence Molloy is running for reelection. He's a very good environmentalist and reform candidate who the old boy network is trying to take out with a very well-funded challenge from John Creighton. Creighton got over 50% of the vote in the primary, so Molloy needs all the help he can get. He's really a voice of sanity on what is probably definitely the most corrupt agency in county politics. The Port of Seattle just plays footsie with too many big businesses and gives them too many taxpayer dollars and has too little accountability for us to be able to afford not to have somebody holding a light on the cockroaches scurrying for the floorboards. So Lawrence Molloy very much in that first race, and that's a dynamic that informs these other races also, because they both involve reform candidates trying to run against run against the old school, as it were. We have Pat Davis, who is probably the worst of the commissioners. She's also the person who brought you WTO. She's running for re-election. She's running against Jack Jolly, who is, as I say, a reform candidate, very well qualified. I very much support Jolly. And then we have an open seat in which Richard Berkowitz is running against Lloyd Hara. Now, we endorsed Hara in the print edition of Eat the State, and got this outraged letter from Berkowitz's campaign manager saying, among other things, well, Hara's been endorsed by some Republicans, so you can't have him. Berkowitz, on the other hand, is on a joint mailer that was put out by a pro-business group as running as a slate along with Pat Davis.
that tells you something right there.
Yeah, it tells you what his priorities are. He has his roots in the working class and the labor unions as a waterfront worker, but so did Jack Block, who before Lawrence Molloy took him out 4 years ago, was a horrible voice on this Port of Seattle Commission for 24 years. He was very difficult to dislodge. So I don't trust Richard Berkowitz. I'm going to stick with my endorsement of Lloyd Hara in that race.
So I'm thinking of those three races as you vote for the L's: Molloy, Jolly, Lloyd Hara.
I hadn't thought of that. That's good.
It's a good way to remember it when you're at the polls.
And that's the election for November 8th. Get out and vote.
All right. And like we always say, you know, make your own decisions. These are just recommendations from the editorial board there at Eat the State.
And again, it's all posted at www.eatthestate.org, and also the initiatives and ballot measures from last week for people who missed that.
All right. Under 10 minutes left. George Bush rolls out a flu plan this week.
Yes, indeed. He announced his flu plan, which involves about $7.1 billion in tax money for not very much that's going to help if we do have a flu pandemic. The biggest chunk of it would go towards funding new drugs and this new vaccine. It's not sure whether this vaccine will even help. I mean, the avian flu virus has to mutate before it becomes a human pandemic, and it can mutate in any number of different ways, making the current experimental vaccine completely ineffective. So we could be pouring billions of dollars down a rat hole there. In addition, it's not clear whether the antiviral drugs Relenza and Tamiflu will even work against a new human pandemic strain. There's some signs already that they have limited effectiveness in the current avian flu bug. And in addition, if you stock up on these antivirals and you start using them on every little, you know, sniffle that you get, they will start to lose their effectiveness. And when you do need them, they might not even be able to work, even though they should. So there's that. In addition, the states are all up in arms too, because George Bush in his last budget cut $130 million in health care aid to the states. And now in this current plan, he wants to restore about $100 million of it, which means that states still get a $30 million cut in health care funds. And he's also asking states to pony up a whole bunch of their own money to pay for stocking up on these antiviral drugs. So it doesn't make any sense, really. It's the Bush administration pouring a lot of money down a hole that is basically going to benefit only these drug companies. In addition, the plan includes exempting these drug companies from any kind of lawsuits if the experimental vaccines that they come up with and the drugs that they come up with to treat a potential human pandemic cause any kind of deaths or injuries. In addition, a part of his plan, or actually a bill that is being passed very rapidly and shockingly rapidly through the Senate and will probably go as rapidly through the House, includes setting up an agency. Let me find the name for it here. The agency is called the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Agency. And it's going to be tasked with coming up with all kinds of different treatments for various bioterrorism attacks, as well as supposed to deal with a human flu pandemic. Well, the scary thing about this is it's going to be a highly secretive agency. It will be the only federal agency exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. The only federal agency. So even the CIA is not exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. But for some reason, this new Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Agency is going to be exempt from any kind of public information searches.
And this is an agency that will work very closely with a big pharmaceutical corporation. So So there's a lot not to trust there.
So it's very scary and not very effective. It looks a lot to me like the way the Bush administration conducts the war in Iraq. Pour a lot of money down something that's a big waste for everybody except for the pockets of shareholders of major corporations.
So that bill is Senate Bill 1873 that currently is being rocketed through.
Yeah, give a call to Cantwell and Murray.
Well, but one of the beneficiaries of this current influx of money is none other than a local corporation. I'm sorry, not local. It's California-based, Gilead Sciences, which gets money from Roche for its production of Tamiflu. They make 10% of all the Tamiflu sales. And guess who's on the board, or guess who's a former chairman of Gilead?
Okay.
None other than Donald Rumsfeld. He's got he was their chairman from 1997 to 2001.
And why am I not surprised?
He's got it's estimated somewhere between $5 to $25 million in stock in that company. So as the U.S. signs up with they already got a $58 million deal with them with Roche, and they're looking at doing another billions of dollars in Tamiflu.
Well, you know, Dick Cheney got his little piece for all the money that went to Halliburton. Now it's Rummy's turn.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is all because Rumsfeld is the only one in the administration who didn't work for an oil company.
Yeah. I guess it's only fair.
Yeah.
All right. Well, quickly, Supreme Court picks. Alito.
Oh, we got a disaster on our hands. This, I think, should be the number one priority for the next couple of months until the Senate hearing, which is now scheduled for January 9th. Samuel Alito would send Rosa Parks to the back of the bus, women into the back alleys for abortions, and police into the bedrooms of innocent and body cavities of innocent Americans. He would be really, really bad. We don't have time to go into all the Supreme Court precedents right now.
Bad for women's rights.
Or district court's precedents, but he's a disaster.
Yeah, he's a disaster. So Alito needs to be defeated. Fortunately, a lot of Republicans in Congress are kind of lukewarm on him as well. So it may be a record here. We may have George Bush proposing two Supreme Court candidates and having to withdraw both of them.
Yeah, that happened to Nixon, by the way, in the early 70s.
Amazing how it's Republicans who have that.
Yeah, he tried to get segregation son of the Supreme Court, and it got shot down twice.
Yeah.
All right. Just time, hopefully, to squeeze in This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
Yeah, the news from Iraq is that several political parties have registered for the December 15th elections. There are five main coalitions. The Shiite United Iraqi Alliance, which is the current group in power, and includes the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, the Dawah Party, and al-Sadr's supporters. The second coalition is the two Kurdish parties, the DKP and the PUK, which is to be expected. They share power right now with the Shiites currently in the government. The third is Ayat Alawi's Iraqi National List. This is supposed to be a group that focuses on secular issues and secular candidates. It includes Ayat Alawi's Iraqi National Accord, the Communist Party, the Socialists, Sunnis without much base of support, including Adnan Pachichi, a returning exile Sunni, and Ghazi al-Yawar, who's a vice president in the current government. So the Iraqi National List, Ayat Alawi, if folks don't remember, was the guy who ran the previous government, and a lot of his ministers are coming under scrutiny right now for corruption. The fourth coalition is Ahmed Chalabi's National Congress for Iraq. It really is pretty much Ahmed Chalabi's supporters. Evidently, he couldn't get along with the other Shiite exile groups in the United Iraqi Alliance, so he split off and has formed his own party now. Although, you know, he gets along just fine with the right-wing extremists in the Bush administration, so I guess that's what really counts. The fifth party, which has gotten the most scrutiny and the most attention from the Bush administration, is the Iraqi Concord Front. It's a new party made up of three Sunni Arab political parties. It's getting all the attention because the Bush administration says it's a sign that the Sunnis are giving up on the insurgency and joining the political process. However, if you look at the three groups that are in this new Sunni Iraqi Concord Front, the names of those three groups are the Iraqi Islamic Party, the Iraqi People's Gathering, and the National Dialogue Council. All three of these groups have been participating in the current government in some form or another already. Two of them participated in the January elections in spite of a widespread Sunni call to boycott the election.
And they're exile groups, right?
I think only one of them is. The Iraqi People's Gathering received only 15,000 votes in that election, so that shows you how little support that they actually have. So these Sunni groups that are supposed to be the, oh gosh, you know, here's the model for the future, they actually don't really represent anybody in the Sunni community. So it's pretty obvious that most Sunnis will probably not vote or participate in the December elections, which is the very opposite of what the Bush administration is currently saying and what they are expecting. In addition, this week, the British press, this was all over the British press, that the Pentagon does count Iraqi dead. In fact, in an October 13th report that the Pentagon presented to Congress, there was a graph buried deep within the report. It was entitled Measuring Stability and Security in Iraq. The graph showed that the Pentagon has estimated 26,000 Iraqi casualties, and that number casualties per day has more than doubled in the past 18 months. It's a lowball estimate based on incident reports filed by U.S. troops. And in fact, U.S. troops, although they are required to fill out incident reports when they respond to violence or when they are engaged in a firefight with insurgents, etc., they are not required to count the number of casualties, although many of them do. And that's where this lowball estimate comes from. This story has been pretty widely ignored by the U.S. press, although it was splashed all over the British press and it was in the French press agency. The only major U.S. outlet that carried a full story on it that I could see was the New York Times. Although you may have seen one or two stories here and there, and There was, I think, a tiny single paragraph blurb in the local newspaper. And this is in spite of the fact that the U.S. media last week splashed all over their headlines, 2,000 dead U.S. soldiers in Iraq.
All right. Unfortunately, out of time. Talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And where can people find Eat the State?
The current issue has our election picks in it, as does the web. You can find the print edition wherever you find free publications, at bookstores and cafes and places like that. The website is www.eatthestate.org. And if you're a campaign manager or a volunteer, or you want to contribute, you want to help out, or just have feedback, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-719-6947.
But please don't send us any mailings.